I've never been Christian personally. So in some ways that makes it easier because I know a lot of my Christian friends have all kinds of, stuff about their families and different things that they have to overlays. I just have a fresh mind about Christianity. And sometimes I think it helps me approach Jesus. And forgive me, I may say things that just seem ridiculous to you, so or sacrilegious. And so, but I approach him with sort of an open heart, like as a spiritual master. That's how I think of him. He's a spiritual master. And so I'm really interested. And I've read the Bible cover to cover a number of years ago. So it's just fair. And the Sermon on the Mount in particular, I've really liked a lot. I've read that many, many times. It's really just really captivated me over the years. So I just had this sort of intuitive notion to share something and parallels, because there are parallels. I mean, it's really been struck reading. Oh my goodness, this kind of there's a lot of chords ringing here. So I thought I would share those. And also at this Christmas season, I try to do something about the life of the Buddha or some of these. Well, I did a thing about Christianity a couple years ago, but the life of the Buddha, just something about the seasonal moment. So I think I'm going to do. Actually, it's a good question. Let me ask you. Because you are some of the people who come often. A number of years ago, I did a slideshow about the life of the Buddha going through India. I was thinking of doing that again. Does that ring a bell? Would
That was over there,
I don't know. But would you like to see that again? Would that be fun? Or?
It made so many things get real for
Okay.
me, like we
Yeah.
talked about,
Yeah.
stupas and all that stuff.
Yeah. Okay. So funny. This is the Yiddish form stupas. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, well, I can do that. Okay, so, but I mean, we live in a Christian country, and Christmas is just, to me, this holiday is the closest thing we have to a sacred holiday. We have all kind of lights up in our house, and I don't know if they're Christmas lights or solstice lights, but there they are, and I, like many people, I feel uplifted by Christmas. But the core part of it is, this Jesus person. So, thought I'd bring this in. And it is pretty amazing the parallels with the Sermon on the Mount. And as far as I understand it, the backstory is this is after he'd been, what's the word, baptized, and after the 40, after he'd met with, been tempted by the devil, the time in the in the wilderness. And so he was really, and people were really starting to approach him. So he gave this teaching on a hill outside of, overlooking the Sea of Galilee. So whether it was a mount or a tall hill, nothing in Israel as tall as the Cascades, so it's all relative, but it was a kind of a mount. But I think what's one thing is really remarkable is how both teachers, the Buddha and Jesus, they flip a lot of our assumptions about life upside down. They really challenge us and stretch us in really parallel ways. And that's part of what's so intriguing, because most of us, we kind of navigate life, I mean, speaking for my humble self, in kind of a materialist sense-seeking kind of way. And we kind of have fun and we try to do the best stuff we can in the life we got. And in terms of the actual questions of life and death, maybe there's some lip service, some attention, but to actually have it flip your life over, that's amazing. To transform how you live. And these two did. These two did. And here in the 21st century, I mean, it's even more ridiculous because there's giant industries completely put together to entertain us and to try to make our life pleasant and to get us to buy stuff that we're convinced will make us pleasant and all of that. So this radical flipping that these two did, this radical transformation is so amazing. And to be sure, they had very different cosmological views, it seems. I mean, Jesus had a relationship with a single God, monotheistic tradition, and the Buddha specifically didn't. It's not a theistic tradition. So that's a radical, significant difference, at least on one level. So it's interesting, given that, how similarly they saw things at the same time in some aspects. And to be sure, I'm cherry picking from the Sermon on the Mount because some things are a little more difficult. So, but the places of similarity was what I was seeking out. And it's interesting that in what they share, it's about kind of attitude in daily life, like how we navigate the actual life in front of us. The Buddha talks about everything, including practice. In the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus is really talking about life, but the parallels with how the Buddha talks about how to conduct life are really striking. Just those face-to-face things. So there's four similarities that I want to talk about. And it's probably going to be pretty brief, so we'll get a chance to talk. But the first of the four, it's contained in what's called the Beatitudes, and that's a list of 10 things. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit. Or you've probably heard all that, and the Beatitudes are wonderful. But there was one that I really that just jumped out at me a lot is blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. And you know, if you transpose a little bit, substitute awaken. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall awaken, from Buddhist talk. It's a perfect encapsulation of the Buddhist path. Just that little statement. Blessed are the pure in heart. Because think about the Noble Eightfold Path, where the Buddha taught how to practice. Four Noble Truths, the fourth is the Eightfold Path. And the bedrock of it, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, they all are choices that purify the heart. They're like fundamental to making the practice work. You know, we can't do this meditation, sitting cross-legged stuff and not purify the heart. And if we do purify the heart, we don't have to do the, I mean, the meditation is the fine tuning, the deep tuning. But even if we didn't meditate, if we really purified the heart, that would get us mostly there. And if we just meditated and didn't purify the heart, we might as well go play Parcheesi. So it's the core of it. It's so beautiful. So that just really seems so amazing, you know? And how do we purify? We purify by ethics. We purify by putting others first, you know, by kindness. You look at the five precepts, the ethical boundaries, in essence, they all are about not putting others first. If we steal something, we're putting ourselves ahead of the person from whom we stole it. If we lie to someone, we're generally manipulating reality to get something for us versus the other person that we lied to. Sexual misconduct is like that. You know, it's all like that. So to flip it and put others first, that's how, one of the ways, we purify the heart. And you can see how ethics and purifying are completely interwoven. So it's getting us closer to awakening and, from Jesus' point of view, getting closer to God. How cool is that? That they're actually pointing in the same direction. And, you know, in our practice, there's some balance. And for those of you who hadn't been here, there's like essentially two forms of meditation. There's samadhi or shamatha meditation, which is concentration, stabilizing the mind. And then there's mindfulness, which is being aware moment by moment. And in the course of practice, we're sort of navigating between those two. There's elements of both of those happening, depending on how your practice is and where you are and everything. But that's two that sort of they interweave in this practice. And that's another way of looking at purifying the heart. Because when you really settle, there's a steadiness that arises naturally if our hearts are pure. And then we can pay attention if our hearts are pure because we're not distracted. One of the requirements for establishing shamatha of absorption is getting past the five hindrances of distraction and greed and aversion and sloth and torpor and restlessness. And those often have to do with non-purifying the heart. That's the way they come up. So the more we cleanse, the more we work on that purification, the hindrances fall away and absorption becomes easier. The Buddha said, I'm going to have some quotes in here, by the way, so you don't have to listen to me. The Buddha said, a mind that is pure, a mind that is uncorrupted, from such a mind happiness follows. like a shadow that never departs. So that's that same sense. It just seems so parallel. The second parallel is it's versions of love your enemy. And this is like just the most radical and wonderful thing that both of them did. I mean, the love your enemy is just profound in what Jesus taught and profound in what the Buddha taught. And this is what, I mean, this is where it always captures my, because it's so opposite of what most of us do, what most of the world does, to love your enemy. Oh my goodness. Jesus said, and this is all quotes from the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus said, "You have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies, bless those who curse you, do good to those who hate you, and pray for those who spitefully use and persecute you." How's that for a high bar? Right? And then he says, "You have heard it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I tell you not to resist an evil person. But whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn the other to him also. If anyone wants to sue you and take away your tunic, let him have your cloak also." And I was, you know, wonder that particular one, it's hard to navigate in a way. I don't think he's talking about being a pushover. I think he's talking about being generous beyond what people can comprehend. I think that's what he's really talking about. And it's just amazing. Just to vow not to retaliate, but to bring love and blessings just to those who are worse to us. And there's teachings that show up. There's a wonderful book, if any of you are the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, which is written by Shantideva in the 8th century in India. And in that book, there's a number of teachings. It's a theme that the Dalai Lama also returns to over and over, that your greatest enemy is your greatest teacher, because you have this incredible opportunity to practice patience, to cultivate love towards this impossible person. And it's a stretch. You know, and even in a smaller way, sometimes, well, you know, we just had Thanksgiving. Sometimes that's a little challenging for some of us, being with family. And, you know, it's a great learning to find a way to have goodwill towards someone who's being difficult or has some political positions that drive us crazy or whatever. You know, but it's that place where we stretch, where we consciously love even when it seems like they're an enemy. That is such powerful work. And so Jesus isn't speaking about worldly difficulty or success. He's speaking about getting closer to God. And that's where this is transcendent, because that's what the Buddha is talking about also. It's not just about winning. Maybe you're just going to lose if you give your tunic, you know. Maybe, but you're going to get closer to God. You're going to shift. And that's ultimately what it's about, because, you know, this is a short lifetime. And then it's going to end. It's funny, when children said that at that teaching, she said, I was really struck. She said, "How many people think they're going to die?" Remember? And I thought, yeah, I'm really thinking. I mean, I feel like I'm seeing the, you know, come. I mean, I don't think I'm going to die anytime soon, but at the same time, I'm super aware of it. I thought that was really challenging what she did, and wonderful. So yeah, it's going to happen. How do we work with that? You know, how do we really, really work with that? Make that define what we're doing, and then we can live in a more precious way. Doesn't mean we're gloomy. I can actually make it more vivid. It just means we don't waste our time. So in terms of this question of how to respond to an enemy, there's a wonderful sutta, which I've called the Simile of the Saw, which I've mentioned here before, and he gets equally radical. He says, "Bhikkhus, even if bandits were to sever you savagely limb by limb with a two-handled saw, he who gives rise to a mind of hate toward them would not be carrying out my teaching. Herein, bhikkhus, you should train thus. Our minds will remain unaffected, and we shall utter no evil words. We shall abide compassionate for their welfare with a mind of loving kindness without inner hate. We shall abide pervading them with a mind imbued with loving kindness." Isn't that just about the same kind of radical? I mean, two-handed, that's like, that is so graphic. I love that. Not just any saw, a two-handled saw. And to actually cultivate in any way a mind of compassion. And people do. It's not just like goofy fantasy. There's some amazing stories about some of the lamas who is a wonderful story. One of the lamas, I think he was in a Chinese jail for 2 decades or something, finally came out, and he's meeting with the Dalai Lama in Ganeshpur, in Dharamsala, recently got out of China somehow. And he says, "Oh, Your Holiness, I was in great danger." And he says, "Oh, yes, I know, you were in such a..." He said, "No, you don't understand, I was in danger of hating them, but I didn't." And he held his practice during all that time when he was being tortured and everything in a Chinese prison. So it's amazing, but we can do that in here, you know, without getting political. But in our political circumstance where there's many people who think the other is wrong on both, you know, every side you got others are thinking the other ones are completely misguided and wrong. So to cultivate loving kindness toward all those folks, whatever, wherever we're at, is powerful. And these guys, as in the Buddha and Jesus, are setting a high bar for how we can do that. But the fact that they're both saying almost the same thing in a very different cosmology, in a different era, a different place, a different time, is so cool. And so it helps us understand how these are core spiritual values, irrespective of whether you're monotheistic or not or anything. These are core spiritual values that can change our hearts and minds. And even, you know, another big difference, that rebirth is a core aspect of the Dharma. We've had many, many, infinitely many lifetimes from that point of view, and we're going to continue, whereas Christianity kind of commonly accepted based on some kind of eternal heaven and hell. So it's a real different sense of how this works. I don't have to get into the differences, it doesn't matter, but the point is, in both traditions, just because of that, we're called on to do things that are at first blush aren't what we would reactively do. We're called on to do the opposite because of this reincarnation phenomena that otherwise we keep going endlessly, or heaven and hell. So it's sort of an ultimate level. Both of these great masters are pointing us to a sense of the sacred, and that we cross the threshold precisely by not acting in conventional ways, by really stretching ourselves in difficult situations. It's pretty powerful. And, oh, by the way, there is debate about whether or not rebirth was accepted in Christianity prior to the Second Council of Constantinople in 553 AD. And there's places tucked in the Bible where there's references even of John the Baptist talks about our former lifetime. So there's little references that are snuck in the Bible that didn't make it through the censors or whatever. So another talk. And I don't know enough, but I'm aware that it's not a rigid distinction. But whatever that means. A third, four aspects, has to do with the entire arena of generosity. Like, what is about how to do it? It's pretty amazing. Because in both cases, and in kind of similar ways, they point us away from generosity as a public act in which we're performing for the gaze or approval of others, and to really have it be an act of giving. It's because it can be sort of this, you know, what is that? Virtue? What's that word? Virtue signal. Thank you. It can be like that, you know, if we're not mindful about what we're doing. Yeah, my wife has taught me that one, so I must do it. But both of them frame generosity as a transcendent act. I mean, you got this real sense of this transcendence. And sometimes that, you know, because the cosmologies are so different, but the attitude is the same, it kind of stretches us about what's going on here, because it's not like one is right and one is wrong. I don't think that way at all. But both are pointing us in this sense of transcendence out of just materiality into other. And then we can kind of work with that and see how it comes alive for us. And sometimes when there's two different ways of interpreting something that neither of them is right or wrong, then if in between you can actually get a feel for it, because you don't get stuck in the concretization of one idea or another. It makes you stretch, and then you can shift something in your heart. So it actually can be really useful to look deeper just when it doesn't seem like they agree. Because in both cases, they're looking at generosity as a transcendent act which takes place in some unseen realm and reaps fruit in ways that are invisible to us. That is so interesting. Jesus said, take heed, that you do not do your charitable deeds before men to be seen by them. Otherwise, you have no reward from your Father in heaven. But when you do a charitable deed, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, that your charitable deed may be in secret, and your Father who sees in secret will himself reward you openly. So you can do all kinds of transposing, but the point is to look at the energy of it, to be generous, you know, to have it come out of kindness. It's pretty cool, pretty wonderful. The Buddha has similar lines in the numerical discourses in the Book of Sevens. He says, one gives a gift without expectation of reward. This is the perfection of giving. So what's the fruit of giving? Like, why is generosity a good thing? And one aspect is that aforementioned purification of mind. You know, giving, it's because, I mean, it's funny. Well, you know, giving takes us out of our sense of self, is what it does. This small I that we're so obsessed with, you know, when we actually give with a generous heart, especially if we do it secretly and nobody knows, that's really cool. And it takes us out of concretizing around ourself, orbiting around ourself, that whole thing that just locks us into me. As Children was talking about, she talked for like an hour and a half about a zillion different enumerations of me. It was pretty funny, but it's true. And I think she never actually got to dependent arising or emptiness. She just stayed in the me. But I think she was working the feeling the audience. I was trying to figure that out, and I said, oh, that's what she was doing, because I wanted to hear the emptiness part. But I think she was really, it's so powerful, just that me. And so giving takes us out of me. You know, especially if you give something that you liked, or if your giving means you can't buy something you like because you gave, you know, all that stuff. Just that attitude of caring for others before oneself is so helpful. And in some way, by doing that, we come in contact with a vaster sense of sacred reality. That's what awakening's about. Something bigger opens up. Be that God or Buddha nature or emptiness, however we look at it, there is some interweaving commonality among those aspects, those words. I don't even try, you know. Is God empty? Is Buddha nature empty? Is Buddha nature the same as God? Is when people talk about the Dharmakaya and Vajrayana practice, are they really talking about the thing that other people say is God, and they're actually, these great masters are almost 99% in exactly the same place? I kind of think so. So I sort of kind of hold it in a big arm. And it's a huge part of how we cultivate not clinging, you know, giving, and how awaken mind. So these two traditions are giving us almost an identical stance about how to do it, even if the technical understanding is different. And then the fourth is another related area of transcendence, which is our relationship to kind of the sense pleasures and physical accumulations of the world. And I tend to do a lot of this work on talks in the Kirkland Library, my favorite library, because it has stand-up desks, and it's a very nice library. And I was struck, I was thinking about this, and I went over to the collection of periodicals and walked around the periodicals. And when you look at them in a certain way, there's multiple magazines on cars, on boats, on travel, on music, on home decor, clothing, and architecture. Like two-thirds of them are all about that kind of different stuff. And all these like finer points and enumerations of what's going to bring pleasure, basically, and what's going to be a good thing to buy and not so good a thing to buy, and why you want to get which car, one Motor Trend this year for 20, you know, all this stuff about things that we can acquire, which is actually kind of a bizarrely, for most people, that's kind of a recent development in human history. I mean, most people are just trying to survive most of the time and lived in tribal situations, whereas just a whole sphere of understanding is totally different. I had a great, my wife and I, my wife's a little bit Native, and had a great privilege. We were stayed in the Hopi Nation. We've been there twice. We were there for 5 days in the spring and got a chance to be with some elders. And it's just so amazing. I mean, they were one tribe, because as some of you may know, the Hopi Nation is surrounded by the Navajo Nation. So it's in the middle of the Navajo reservation, and the Navajo is huge. It's the size of Rhode Island. Navajo Nation is enormous. So the Hopi Nation is buffered from everything else because it's surrounded by a whole other Native nation. And within the Hopi Nation, there's only one place you can stay, which is the Hopi Cultural Center. There's no hotels, there's no commercial, there's a few gas stations, pretty much not any commercial anything. But when you talk to people, because there is some Christians, but mostly they've stayed within their traditional ways. And everybody knows, you know, they know what their clan is. I met from the Bear Clan, the Corn Clan, the Moving Water Clan. Just, that's my clan. And we go from the Kiva and we do these ceremonies and, you know, and everyone's that, I overheard some conversations of already been part of a round of some kind of family event, but just a sense of interconnectedness and family. And also, you know, because we do loving kindness, like we cultivate loving kindness, which is good. But there was a sense, it's hard to describe, that when they were talking about loving kindness, they were talking about the corn and the stones and every animal and every insect and the wind. It was all part of one thing that they were, with great respect, it was really pretty awesome. I mean, it's pretty awesome. So I say I'll just take it back to all of our random materialistic choices, especially, what was it, Cyber Monday? Cyber Monday, yeah, right? Craziness, you can go off, buy all kind of things that'll bring you happiness. So you could buy all these things for you, that'd be good, but you can't take it with you, right? And none of it's essential. And actually, none of it actually brings happiness. I mean, they can be a little kind of thrill of the moment, I guess, you know, driving. I think I told you one time, you know, there is actually, I swear this is true, one can buy a Lamborghini SUV. And Lamborghinis are like their Ferraris, you know, these incredibly fast cars. And I met a guy once who had a Lamborghini SUV in the parking lot of the gym I go to, who was really uptight. And it didn't seem to make him happy, is all I'm trying to say. So all that stuff, this is all under the heading of generosity, because he chose to buy the Lamborghini SUV for, like, I don't know what, $200,000. I have no idea what it cost, some ridiculous amount. Generosity maybe would have made him happier. And to flip this another way, you know, spiritual history is filled with beings who had absolutely nothing. Milarepa, some of you know Milarepa, a great Tibetan master. He's renowned for living on nothing but nettles and up in his cave. But he was an awakened being. It was unbelievable. Milarepa, Songs of Milarepa. You can find these books. It's just so amazing. He had zip, you know, ate nettles. His butt was callous from sitting all the time. Or the Desert Fathers. You know, in Christianity, the Desert Fathers, they didn't have nothing. They were out in the desert in the early years of Christianity. And yet they abided in a vast inner light and radiant happiness because of, partly, generosity. Jesus said, "Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroy, and where thieves do not break in and steal. No one can serve two masters. You cannot serve God and mammon." And in Dhammapada, verse 355, the verse says something quite similar. "Wealth destroys the foolish, but it cannot destroy those who seek the other shore," which is nibbana, or awakening. "By his craving for wealth, the fool destroys himself, as he would destroy others." So both masters are suggesting we shed attachment, which is kind of one aspect of being generous, is you shed attachment, because if people didn't want stuff for themselves, you know, what's his name? The guy who started Amazon, I can't believe, I can't remember.
Bezos.
Mr. Bezos, in his extremely large yacht, so large it needs another yacht to help out the first yacht. He wouldn't do that if he had a generous heart. You know, why? How could you even think about that? It's so funny. And these things are transitory. They're a dead end. They lead nowhere. He's going to die. And the yacht, you know, he's going to die. Will he be happy at the time of his death because of the big yacht? I don't know. That's between him and him. But just in our experience of being tugged and wanting stuff, we have an opportunity to shed and let go and to turn towards transcendent awakening. And this whole, you know, generosity, whatever it means to you, just as much as we can make that choice, it's pretty amazing. And as a one side, we're almost done, you know, because we're talking, I'm talking about Maseratis and silly things. But for most people on Earth, that's not Maseratis, forget it. They just need corn on the table, you know? I mean, they just need to eat. This is ridiculousness of our American culture and stuff, that such things are even possible. And, you know, 2025, these are perilous times, right? But 2100 years ago at the time of Jesus, that was a perilous time. 2600 years ago at the time of the Buddha, that was a perilous time. So it's at all those times, there's people, regular people like us, who worry there won't be enough. And we're, you know, and people retired, you know, people are working. Everyone worries a little bit, right? All of us worry a little bit there won't be enough. Somehow we're going to get sick and starve and end up in some kind of grotty little place, something. It's a concern. Right? It's a concern we all live with. I get that in one form or another. But there's several levels to this that are touched on in the Sermon on the Mount, because there's some kind of magicalness that people devoted to the spiritual path somehow have enough to survive, pretty much mostly. You know, it's somehow, it's okay. They don't need much, but it's okay. And there's also a transcendent overtone that even if things are difficult, if we look at a broader sense of what's going on, we can make sense of it. In the Sermon on the Mount, oh yes, and there's a shared metaphor that both the Buddha and Jesus use, having to do with birds, which is so cool. In the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus said, "Therefore I say to you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat or what you will drink, nor about your body, what you will put on. Is not life more than food, and the body more than clothing? Look at the birds of the air, for they neither sow nor reap nor gather into barns, yet your heavenly Father feeds them." And in the long discourses, the Buddha says something so similar. He says, "A monk is content with a robe to protect his body, with alms food to satisfy his stomach, and having accepted sufficient, he goes on his way. Just as a bird with wings flies hither and thither, burdened by nothing but its wings, so he is satisfied." So that's a beautiful parallel there, having to do with generosity, also with just non-attachment, just some ease. I mean, we don't need as much as we thought. We're probably going to be okay. And maybe even if things are kind of difficult, the inner light can make it not difficult. That's something I used to work in a nursing home many decades ago. And I learned some stuff there, because there was a sector of people in the nursing home who'd had very external lives. I'd ask people about their lives, and there were, you know, a few women who used to be really beautiful. Or there was one woman who used to travel in Africa and all kinds of exotic places. And some of those people were bitter, basically. It's like, what happened? Basically, like, hello, but what happened? They were bitter. I mean, the African woman, she was kind of blind, and she was bitter and angry, and she was having a terrible time because they had posited on an external circumstance. She had enough to eat, but there was several other women, even if there was someone who had Alzheimer's, but it didn't matter, who'd been very lovely, kind of Christian, just, they were just radiant, these women, and they didn't have anything. I mean, you look at it one way, they're basically invalids. They're stuck. In fact, I don't think this is out of line. This teamwork is great, because I can't remember names so well. I don't know if that has anything to do with age. I can't imagine. But our friends in Gig Harbor, who come once in a while, Bruce, yes, and Sean. Thank you. What a team. Bruce and Sean. She has MS. I've gotten to know her pretty well. They come once in a while. She had a very, very active life. They lived in Hawaii. She was surfing and doing all kinds of intense, just cool stuff, and then got MS. And now she's basically bedridden, you know, and they live in a place in Gig Harbor. And then he got cancer a few years ago, and they went through a really difficult period they were having a hard time inwardly. I mean, they're okay, but inwardly they were having a hard time. And then they just kicked in their Dharma practice, and they've been doing retreats like, I think they did like 6 weeks of retreat this year, all online from their beds in their little place in Gig Harbor. They're cooking. I mean, they're really happy. It's really amazing. You know, it's really amazing. So, and Sean writes letters to prisoners. You know, that's one thing she figured out she could do that brings love. So, you know, having enough, being at peace with what we have, giving away even when we don't have much. You know, I'm on the board of Tibetan Nuns Project, and there's a group of us board members. We thank people for every donation gets called or emailed by a board member. And if we were debating how to do that at one point, because, you know, some people give $1,000 and some people give five. But we just said, no, we're going to call everybody. And you talk to these, I mean, sometimes it's like this lady in Mississippi on social security, giving $5 is a big deal. So kind. And she's all happy about it. She gave $5. Someone else $1,000, you know, just part of my trust fund. But the $5, that was joy. So this whole thing about generosity and the way it's talked about here. Yeah, I'm almost done. Where are we at now? We're good. My first Buddhist teacher, General Genla Rinpa. Venerable. He was so amazing. He came here to Seattle in 1988. And he said that anyone who's truly dedicated to the Dharma would not starve. And I've often seen that, like Tenzin Palmo. She did 12 years, you know, in a retreat in a cave up in the Himalayas. And Theravada monks, they do Tudong. You know what Tudong is? That's when Theravada monks, they just wander. And they just wander. And these monks here, they've done Tudong like on the East Coast, down in California. They've done Tudong in India, just wandering with a begging bowl, with an alms bowl. And, you know, people are going to put food in their bowl, probably. And if not, then they miss a day. But it's fine. They're not going to starve. That's the amazing thing. So this generosity. Jesus said, therefore, do not worry, saying, what shall we eat? Or what shall we drink? Or what shall we wear? For your heavenly Father knows you need all these things. But seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added to you. So maybe we can, the closing, you know, just find a certain peace, knowing that these great beings saw so many things similarly, even though obviously they didn't know each other. Their cultures didn't touch hardly, or maybe more than we think. But in any case, that they saw in similar ways. And even in the middle of the difficulties of the world, where there's brutality and shortages, and I watch the news, I know what's going on. Even in the middle of that, we can find equanimity and happiness and find ways to offer love back, even in the middle of it, just to the person that seems like the worst perpetrator, just to that person to offer love back. So I think there's no doubt that the Buddha and Jesus, they saw this because they'd had enormous awakening, transformational change. We can debate, we don't have to debate what the nature of, but they were fundamentally different than just normal folks. And we can do that too. Just for us, now back to us on the Buddhist path, that's how we can be. You know, that tremendous change, that's why we're doing this. So, sit for a moment.